5. In his own personal car, Stenog took him to his house for dinner. As they drove through the afternoon traffic, Parsons tried to see as much of the city as possible. Once, when the car halted for a three-level bus, he rolled down the window and leaned out. Stenog made no move to inhibit his actions. "There's where I work," Stenog said once. He slowed the car and pointed. A flat building, larger than any others that Parsons had seen, lay to their right. "That's where we were in my office at the fountain. That means nothing to you, but you were at the most highly guarded spot we possess. We've been all this time getting through the check stations." They had been in the car now for almost half an hour. "Every day I have to go through this," Stenog said. "And I'm the director of the fountain. But they check me too." A final uniformed guard halted the car, took the flat black card that Stenog showed him, and then the car started up onto a through ramp. The city fell below them. "The Soul Cube is at the fountain," Stenog said, by way of explanation. "But that makes no sense to you either, does it?"
"No,"
Parsons said. His mind was still on the girl and on her death. "Concentric rings," Stenog continued. "Zones of importance. Now, of course, we're out in the tribal areas again." The brightly colored dots that Parsons had first seen now passed by them at high velocity. Stenog did not appear to be a fast driver. In the daylight, Parsons noticed that each passing car had one of the tribal totem animals painted on its door, and on the hoods, metal and plastic ornaments that might have been totem. The cars moved by too fast for him to be certain. "You'll stay with me," Stenog said, "until time for your emigration to Mars. That should be in a day or so. It takes a little time to arrange transportation, what with all the red tape and government forms." The house, small, part of a group of many houses built along the same lines, reminded Parsons of his own house. On the front steps, he halted for a moment.
"Go ahead in," Stenog said. "The car parks itself."
His hand on Parsons' shoulder, he steered him up the steps and onto the porch. The front door, open, let out the sound of music.
"You lived before the age of radio, didn't you?" Stenog said as they entered.
"No," Parsons said. "We had it."
"I see,"
Stenog said. He seemed tired now at the end of the day.
"Dinner should be ready," he murmured.
Sitting down on a long, low couch, he removed his sandals. As Parsons moved about the living room, he realized that Stenog was gazing at him oddly.
"Your shoes," Stenog said. "Didn't you people take off your shoes when you entered a house?"
After Parsons had removed his shoes, Stenog clapped his hands. A moment later, a woman appeared from the back of the house wearing a flowing, brightly colored robe, her feet bare. She paid no attention to Parsons. From a low cabinet set against the wall, she brought forth a tray on which stood a ceramic pot and a tiny glazed cup. Parsons smelled tea as the woman set the tray down on a table near the couch on which Stenog sat. Without a word, Stenog poured himself tea and began to drink. None for me, Parsons thought. Because he was a criminal? Or were all guests treated this way? The differing customs. Stenog had not introduced the woman to him. Was she his wife? His maid? Gingerly, Parsons seated himself on the far end of the couch. Neither Stenog nor the woman gave any sign that he had done rightly or wrongly. The woman kept her black eyes fixed on Stenog while he drank. She too, like all the others Parsons had seen in this world, had the long, shiny hair, the dark coloring. But in her he thought he saw one difference. This woman seemed less dainty, more heavily built.
"This is my Puella," Stenog said,
having finished his cup of tea.
"Let's see."
He relaxed, yawned, obviously glad to be out of his office and in his own home.
"Well, there's probably no way I can express it to you. We have a legal relationship, recorded by the government. It's voluntary. I can break it, she can't." He added, "Her name is Amy."
The woman held out her hand to Parsons. He took it and found himself shaking hands. This hadn't changed, this custom. The sense of continuity raised his morale slightly, and he found himself, too, relaxing.
"Tea for Dr. Parsons," Stenog said.
While the two men sipped tea, Amy fixed dinner somewhere out of sight, behind a fragile-looking screen that Parsons recognized as distinctly Oriental. And here, as in his office, Stenog had a harpsichord. On this one stood a stack of sheet music, some of it very old-looking. After dinner, Stenog rose and said, "Let's take a run down to the fountain." He nodded to Parsons. "I want you to understand our point of view." Together in Stenog's car, they drove through the night darkness. The air, fresh and cold, blew around Parsons. The younger man kept the windows down, clearly from habit. He seemed withdrawn into himself, and Parsons did not try to talk to him. As they were being processed through the check stations once more, Stenog abruptly burst out. "Do you consider this society morbid?"
"There are strains of it," Parsons said. "Visible to an outsider, the emphasis on death."
"On life, you mean?"
"When I first got here, the first person who saw me tried to run me down and kill me, thinking I wanted to be killed."
"And Ikora," he thought.
"That person probably saw you roaming around alone at night, on foot, on the public highway."
"Yes," Parsons said.
"That's one of the favorite ways for certain types of dashing individuals with a flair for the spectacular. They go out on the highway outside the city, and it's the custom that the cars that see them run over them. It's time-honored, established. Didn't persons in your society go out at night onto bridges and throw themselves off?"
Parsons said, "But they were a trivial few, a mentally disturbed minority.
Yet the custom, even so, was established within society. It was understood. If you decided to kill yourself, that was the proper way."
Now working himself up emotionally, Stenog said, "Actually, you know nothing about this society. You just came here. Look at this." They had come out in a huge chamber. Parsons halted, impressed by the maze of corridors that stretched off in all directions. Even at night, work continued. The corridors were active and alight. One wall of the chamber looked onto the edge of a cube. Going in that direction, Parsons discovered with a shock that he was seeing only a slice of the cube. Virtually all of it lay buried in the ground, and he could only infer dimly what its full size might be. The cube was alive. The ceaseless undercurrent drummed up from the floor itself. He felt it moving through his body, an illusion created by the countless technicians hurrying back and forth. Self-regulated freight elevators brought up empty containers, loaded themselves with new material, and descended again. Armed guards prowled back and forth, keeping an eye on things. He saw them watching even Stenog, but the sense of life was not an illusion. He felt the emanation from the cube, the churning, a controlled, measured metabolism, but with a peculiar overtone of restlessness. Not a tranquil life, but with the tidal ebb and flow of the sea. Disturbing to him, and also to the other people. He caught on their faces the same fatigue and tension that he had seen with Stenog. And he felt coldness rising from the cube. Odd, he thought. Alive and cold. Not like our life. Not warm. In fact, he could see the breaths of the individuals in the corridors. His own, Stenog's, the white fog blown out by each of them, the pneuma.
"What is in it?" he asked Stenog. Stenog said, "We are."
At first, he did not understand. He assumed the man meant it metaphorically. Then, by degrees, he began to see.
"Zygotes," Stenog said, "arrested and frozen in cold pack by the 100 billion. Our total seed, our hoard, the race is in there. Those of us now walking around," he made a motion of dismissal, "a minute fraction of what's contained in there, the future generations to come."
So, Parsons thought, their minds aren't fixed on the present. It's the future that's real to them.
those to come, in a sense, are more real than those who are walking around now.
How is it regulated? He asked Stenog.
We keep a constant population, roughly 2¾ billion. Each death automatically starts a new zygote from Cold Pack along its regular developmental path. For each death, there is an instantaneous new life. The two are interwoven.
Parsons thought, so out of death comes life.
In their view, death is the cause of life.
Where do the zygotes come from? He inquired.
Contributed according to a specific and very complex pattern. Each year we have lists, contest examinations between the tribes, tests that cover all phases of ability, physical fitness, mental faculties, and intuitive functioning at every level and of every description and orientation, from the most abstract to the object correlatives, the manual skills.
With comprehension, Parsons said, the contribution of gametes is proportional to the test ratings of each tribe. Stenog nodded.
In the last lists, the wolf tribe gained 60 victories out of 200. Therefore, it contributed 30% of the zygotes for the next period, more than the three next highest scoring tribes. As many gametes as possible are taken from the actual high-scoring men and women. The zygotes are always formed here, of course. Unauthorized zygote formation is illegal. But I don't want to offend your sensibilities. Extremely talented persons have made substantial contributions, even where their particular tribes have scored low. Once a gifted individual is located, all efforts are made to obtain his or her total supply of gametes. The mother superior of the wolf tribe, for example. None of Loris's gametes are lost. Each is removed as it is formed and immediately impregnated at the fountain. Inferior gametes, the seed of low scores, are ignored and allowed to perish.
Now, with first real clarity, Parsons grasped the underlying scheme of this world. Then your stock is always improving.
Of course, Stenog said, surprised.
And the girl, Ikora, she wanted to die because she was maimed, disfigured. She knew she would have had to compete in the lists that way.
She would have been a negative factor. She was what we call substandard. Her tribe would have been pulled down by her entry. But as soon as she was dead, a superior zygote from a later stock than her own was released. And at the same time, a 9-month embryo was brought out and severed from the soul cube. A beaver died, therefore this new baby will wear the emblem of the beaver tribe. It will take Ikora's place.
Parsons nodded slowly. Immortality.
Then death, he realized, has a positive meaning. Not the end of life, and not merely because these people wish to believe, but because it is a fact. Their world is constructed that way.
This is no idle mysticism, he realized. This is their science.
On the drive back to Stenog's house, Parsons contemplated the bright-eyed men and women along the route. Strong noses and chins, clear skins, a handsome race of imposing men and full-breasted young women, all in the prime of youth, laughing, hurrying through their fine city. He caught a glimpse, once, of a man and woman passing along a spidery ramp, a strand of shimmering metal connecting two spires. Neither of them was over 20, holding hands as they rushed along, talking and smiling at each other. The girl's small, sharply etched face, slender arms, tiny feet in sandals. A rich face, full of life and happiness and health. Yet this was a society built on death. Death was an everyday part of their lives. Individuals died and no one was perturbed, not even the victims. They died happily, gladly. But it was wrong. It was against nature. A man was supposed to defend his life instinctively, place it before everything else. This society denied a basic drive common to all life forms. Struggling to express himself, he said, "You invite death. When someone dies, you're glad."
Death, Stenog said, is part of the cycle of existence, as much so as birth. You saw the soul cube. A man's death is as significant as his life.
He spoke disjointedly as traffic ahead of him caused him to turn his attention back to driving. And yet, Parsons thought, this man does everything he can to avoid piling up his car. He's a careful driver. A contradiction. In my own society, nobody thought about death. The system in which he had been born, in which he had grown up, had no explanation for death. A man simply lived out his life and tried to pretend that he wouldn't die. Which was more realistic? This integration of death into the society, or the neurotic refusal of his own society to consider death at all? Like children, he decided, unable and unwilling to imagine their own deaths. That's how my world operated, until mass death caught up with us all, as apparently it did.
Your forefathers, Stenog said, the early Christians, I mean, hurled themselves under chariot wheels. They sought death, and yet out of their beliefs came your society.
Parsons said slowly, we may ignore death. We may immaturely deny the existence of death, but at least we don't court death.
You did indirectly, Stenog said. By denying such a powerful reality, you undermined the rational basis of your world. You had no way to cope with war and famine and overpopulation because you couldn't bring yourselves to discuss them. So war happened to you. It was like a natural calamity, not man-made at all. It became a force. We control our society. We contemplate all aspects of our existence, not merely the good and pleasant.
For the rest of the trip, they drove in silence. After they had gotten out of the car and had started up the front steps of the house, Stenog paused at a shrub that grew by the porch. In the porch light, he directed Parsons' attention to the various blooms.
What do you notice growing? He said, lifting a heavy stalk.
A bud.
Stenog lifted another stalk.
And here is a blooming flower. And over here a dying flower, past its bloom.
He took a knife from his belt, and with one swift, clean swipe, he severed the dying flower from the shrub and dropped it over the railing.
You saw two things. The bud, which is the life to come. The blossom, which I cut off so that new buds could form.
Parsons was deep in thought. But somewhere in this world, there's someone who doesn't think like you do. That must be why I was brought here. Sooner or later,
they'll show up,
Stenog finished, his face animated. All at once, Parsons understood why no attempt had been made to keep him under careful guard, why Stenog drove him so openly and readily about the city, brought him to his house, to the fountain itself. They wanted the contact made. Inside the house, in the living room, Amy sat at the harpsichord. At first, the music did not seem familiar to Parsons, but after a time, he became aware that she was playing Jelly Roll Morton tunes, but in some strange, inaccurate rhythm.
I got to looking for something from your period, she said, pausing. You didn't happen ever to see Morton, did you? We consider him on a par with Dowland and Schubert and Brahms.
Parsons said, he lived before my time.
Am I doing it wrong? She said, noticing his expression. I've always been fond of music of that period. In fact, I did a paper on it in school.
Too bad I can't play, he said. We had TV in our period. Learning to play a musical instrument had just about vanished as either a social or a cultural experience. In fact, he had never played a musical instrument of any kind. He recognized the harpsichord only from having seen one in a museum. This culture had revived elements from centuries previous to his own, had made them a part of their world. For him, music had been important, but it had come from recordings, or at best, concerts. The idea of playing music in the home was as incredible as owning one's own telescope.
I'm surprised you don't play, Stenog said. He had produced a bottle and glasses. What about this? Fermented drink, made from grains.
I think I recall that, Parsons said with amusement.
Still very seriously, Stenog said, as I understand it, liquor was introduced to take the place of drugs popular during your period. It has fewer toxic side effects than the drugs you're probably familiar with. He opened the bottle and began to pour. From the color and smell, Parsons guessed that the stuff was a sour mash bourbon. He and Stenog sat drinking, while Amy played her eerie version of Dixieland jazz at the harpsichord. The house had a deeply peaceful air, and he felt himself becoming a little more calm. Was this, after all, so vile a society? How, he thought, can a society be judged by an individual created by another society? There's no disinterested standard. I'm merely comparing this world to mine, not to a third. The bourbon seemed, to his taste, unaged. He drank only a little. Across from him, Stenog filled his own glass a second time, and now Amy came over. He watched her go to the cupboard for a glass. Stenog had not gotten one out for her. The status of women. And yet, in his contact with Wade and Ikora, he had not been conscious of this disparity. That illegal political group, he said. What did they advocate? Stenog stirred. Voting rights for women. Although she had her drink, Amy did not join them. She retired to a corner and seated herself, small and quiet and thoughtful. But she did mention going to school, Parsons remembered. So women aren't excluded from educational opportunities. Perhaps education itself, especially non-scientific education, such as a degree in history, has no status here. Something appropriate for women, a mere hobby. Studying his glass, Stenog said, do you like my Puella? Embarrassed, Parsons said, I... He could not keep himself from glancing in her direction. She showed no emotion. You're staying here tonight, Stenog said. You can sleep with Amy if you want. To that, Parsons could say nothing. Guardedly, he looked from Stenog to Amy, trying to make out what actually was meant. Here, the language barrier had betrayed him, and the difference in customs. That's not done in my time segment, he said finally. Well, you're here now, Stenog said with a touch of ire. Certainly, that was true, Parsons considered, and then said, I should think this practice would upset your careful control of zygote formation. At once, both Stenog and Amy started.
Oh, Amy said, of course.
To Stenog, she said, remember, he didn't go through the initiation. With visible uneasiness, she added,
it's a good thing he spoke up. This could be a very dangerous situation. I'm surprised none of you thought about it.
Drawing himself up, Stenog said with pride,
Parsons, prepare to have your sensibilities offended.
That isn't important, Amy said to him. I'm thinking of situations he might get into.
Paying no attention to her, Stenog focused his attention on Parsons.
All males are sterilized at the inception of puberty, he said, an expression of deep satisfaction on his face, myself included. So you can see, Amy said, why this custom causes no particular trouble. But in your case...
No, no, Stenog said. You can't sleep with her, Parsons. In fact, you can't sleep with any of the women.
Now he too had become disturbed.
You should be gotten to Mars, I think, as soon as it's feasible. A thing like this, it could cause great problems.
Approaching Parsons, Amy said,
more to drink?
She started to refill his glass. He did not protest.